So I'm Chris Sharon, by the way, and this week I've been working on connecting faith and popular culture. And this is the last of those sessions in which I really want to talk practically about making decisions about what you listen to, what you buy, what you share with your kids, and try and work constructively, picking up some threads of what I've talked about earlier in the week. And I just decided to play with Bob Marley as an example. Each day I like to ground what I'm doing in a particular case, if you will, particular, you can fill in the blank of other possibilities that you know of. But Bob Marley is a good example, partly because he's so popular. I tend to pick people who are populist because that's what lots of people are listening to. That's who's influential in a way. That's why a couple of days ago I did Lady Gaga. Not because I like Lady Gaga particularly, just because so many people are paying attention to her and I wanted to think about that and why. Well, this is my question. I'm inviting you into a conversation about how do we make faithful judgments about pop culture. And I want to start today by telling a story personally about how I made some progress in this question. I was invited to go to Mount Vernon Nazarene University in Ohio to give a talk about imagination and the kingdom of God. And they had read the book I wrote on theology and the rock band U2, and they wanted me to talk about faith and pop culture as a part of that year-long lecture series, and I was the first one. It was in September, and I did a little background research about Mount Vernon, and if you know anything about Nazarene theology or the Nazarene Church as a denomination, you know that it sort of fits broadly within the evangelical strain of American Protestantism. It's fairly conservative, and this school bends toward a fundamentalist perspective, as the faculty I visited with described it. And they have a code of rules, a code of sort of faith claims that students, faculty, and staff are all expected to pledge allegiance to in order to be a part of the community's life. So I looked through those, and I realized as I was looking through those that my talk I had prepared broke every one of them. And so I began to get very nervous about what I was planning on presenting. And what I was planning on doing was using the rap artist Kanye West. How many of you have heard of Kanye West? Everybody, right? He's obnoxious as hell.
Love him.
And really talented. And I wanted to take Kanye West and use him as an example for thinking through exactly these questions. How do we make judgments? And what do we do with the fact that some people, for many Christians, are just eminently write-offable? In fact, for a certain strand of Christianity, all of hip-hop is eminently write-offable, not just Kanye West. Well, I got there, and I was met by the chair of the lecture committee who teaches psychology, and he did his PhD at Fuller Seminary, so he's in the psychology department, but it's really Christian psychology, and not that that's bad. It just says something about the school and the character. He thought of his teaching of psychology as ministry, and yet he was frustrated with the what he described as the constricted range of possibility that their way of thinking about Christianity offered for engaging popular culture and arts. And he introduced me to a great magazine, Paste Magazine. Anyone know Paste Magazine? A few of you. So their tagline is Signs of Life in Film, Music, and Culture. And it was founded by a couple of self-described post-evangelicals who really, they live in Atlanta, and they have really struggled to create a magazine that believes in this great idea called Common Grace, which really comes out of a Wesleyan tradition as much as any other. The idea of common grace that, in a sense, if we believe that God is the creator of the heavens and the earth, the seas and all that is in them, then there's a common grace that allows for everything that is to be at all. Our lives, all of our lives, all of creation is only here because of God's holding it in being. That common grace allows us to say God is actually at work and present in everything, not just in things that are explicitly Christian, that have Jesus on their lips in a sense. So he introduced me to Pace Magazine. He said, this is my lifeline. You don't know about it, you should know about it. So I've subscribed ever since. Peter Marty asked me, how do you know about all these crazy new pop music artists? And I said, two things. I ask young people, what are you listening to? And I read Pace Magazine. Well, I get into the room and I'm talking with the AV guys getting set up for my talk. Setting up my computer, and I go back into the tech room in the back of the lecture auditorium, and I'm chatting with them about the lecture, and they're like, so what are you going to talk about? You know, they're excited, and I tell them I'm going to talk with Kanye West about Kanye West, and I'm nervous about that, and what do they think? How is that? Am I going to get kicked out of my rear? And they get this sort of goofy smile on their faces, and they go over to the control panel in this glassed-in AV box, and they turn it up, and it's Kanye West. And his new album, Graduation, had just come out that week. And that's part of the reason why I chose to focus on Kanye West, because there had been this big sort of ego battle between the rapper 50 Cent and Kanye about who was going to sell more albums. Their albums were coming out on the same day, that September. So the interesting thing then was, they were loving Kanye West's beat. They were listening to it, and at the very same time, feeling guilty about it, and having no framework for making sense of how their faith might connect to this music that they really liked, other than a disconnect that left them feeling bad that they liked it. And that really stuck in my gut, this combination of a faculty member struggling with this, what he felt like was a constricted imagination, an inability to really think fully and complexly about what was going on in our culture. And then these students who were loving the beats and singing along with the songs, but under the covers in a sense, just like my mom with her radio stuck under the pillow at night listening to Elvis, you know, because her Missouri Synod pastor father would have absolutely condemned those shaking hips. And after that, I mean, I gave the lecture and whatever, and it went okay. Here's why it went okay. I totally challenged them by saying Kanye West might be preaching the gospel. Well, I said he is preaching the gospel. I said he is. I tried to show them how Kanye West is preaching the gospel. Very disturbing. And then I defended it. This was my saving grace, really. I defended it by working theologically out of C.S. Lewis, whom they adore. And it was very unsettling for them to realize that their beloved evangelical theologian, C.S. Lewis, could be used to support the claim that Kanye West is preaching the gospel. And we had a great conversation after my lecture, which left me with more questions than it did answers. And so in part, my own journey has been, in a sense, responding to the complexity of life that I experienced there, but which officially is not there. You get what I mean? The institution doesn't say officially that complexity is present at Mount Vernon Nazarene University, but it actually lives there. So two of the books I've done on pop culture are with a press that explicitly crosses this almost impassable divide between evangelical and progressive Protestantism. They intentionally do that. They try and connect these ecclesial divides that we don't usually connect. And I did that because I want to reach out in a way to talk with these evangelical Christians too. As a couple times this week, I've lamented Holden's absence of more traditionally evangelical Christian voices, because I think I would have some more amens when I say there's some good things about what Focus on the Family is doing. there's some really worrisome things too, and I get amens when I say that. But it's harder to talk about the positive side. Well, what I want to do today is basically walk through, using Bob Marley and the Wailers as an example, walk through what C.S. Lewis offers us as, in a sense, a practical method or process of making judgments that doesn't follow this, what I've called checklist Christianity, or a model or a process of making decisions that I think is rooted in a constricted imagination. Not just about our imagination, but a constricted imagination about who God is and how God is present and active in the world. Here you go, Bob Marley. His famous song, Exodus. That they have is the working out of that crucible of struggle early on in their life, and that's the story he tries to tell. Bob Marley unfortunately died of cancer at age 36. He had a remarkable life in a very short time. Peter Marty was talking about Flannery O'Connor this morning in Bible study. She died at 39. I mean, it's just stunning, isn't it? Dietrich Bonhoeffer, 39. These people who live such short, incandescent lives. Bob Marley was born in Jamaica, as most of you know, and he, in Kingston, joined up with met a number of friends in the late 50s and early 60s, beginning to form bands and play together. The first serious band he played in was the Wailers. And their first album, Catch a Fire, was released in 73. He had some hits before that in the 60s, including I Shot the Sheriff, which Eric Clapton covered and gave him a much wider international audience because of that. The Wailers broke up, and Bob Marley kept playing solo, but called his band the Wailers, even though the original members of the Wailers weren't any longer a part of the group. And he, in this era, in the 60s and 70s, he was brought up Catholic. His father was a British naval officer, a white Englishman in Jamaica, and his mother was an African descent Jamaican. So he came from this mixed race parentage, and it was a complex thing for him in his life to struggle with that, and it in part connected with his call for oneness and unity. And you can hear that in some of his songs, One Love, for example, one of his most famous songs. It also made him acutely aware of what it means to be black, because it didn't really matter that he had a white father. What mattered was that he was dark-skinned in a culture that marks people who have dark skin in a certain way. He became caught up in a movement in Jamaica that was rooted in Marcus Garvey and a kind of back to Africa called Rastafarianism. And some of you probably know more about it than I do. But the basic idea was a connection to Haile Selassie, the king. Was he a king?
Emperor
of Ethiopia. And they considered him, in a sense, the coming again of the Messiah as a black savior, an African savior. And the religion partly revolves around Haile Selassie and about a black African connected sense of justice and of redemption. And it embodies some of the elements of Christianity and some of the elements of Pan-Africanism, which Marcus Garvey and other leaders of that rejection of slavery and of oppression of African Americans set out. And you can hear that in his music too, and it connects to some of his peculiarities, like his dreadlocks. The Lion of Judah is one of the images for Haile Selassie and for the Messiah, and that's scriptural as well as a part of what Rastafarians believe, and the dreadlocks connect with that image. And they also smoked marijuana, ganja. So he got arrested when he was living in London for a couple of years for having ganja. And so one of the sort of stereotypes of Rastafarians is a bunch of people sitting around getting high. It wasn't like the counterculture in the 60s and 70s in the U.S. It was more like, I would say, what Native Americans do with peyote. It was more kind of spiritual illumination in their self-understanding. Like I said, I'm totally not an expert on Rastafarianism. I just know a little bit. I studied in Jamaica when I was in Kingston when I was in college and tried to learn some about it. And I keep learning more. But he became involved, as you can imagine, in the politics of Jamaica because of his sense of the importance of issues of oppression and injustice. And so he ended up playing at some really important large political concerts and was a supporter of causes that related to justice and peace. And he tried to bring together the fighting factions in Jamaica, the political parties in Jamaica, and held some peace concerts to try to bring them together. He also sang and spoke out about issues of the time, apartheid in South Africa, and wrote songs in relationship to many of these international justice issues of the time. He got sick from melanoma, and they were on tour in the late 70s, and he died in 1981 in May in Miami. He's been a remarkable success in the years after his death. I mean, grown to much broader acclaim in the years since his death than he even achieved. And he achieved great stardom during his life. But he was awarded, for example, as his legacy has become more known, in 1999, this album, Exodus, was picked by Time Magazine as the album of the century. In 2004, Rolling Stone ranked him number 11 on their list of the 100 greatest artists of all time. That sounds pompous, but if you think about Rolling Stone, they're thinking about certain kinds of artists, right? They're not thinking about Picasso, per se. They're thinking about pop music artists. And One Love, one of his songs, was named the Song of the Millennium by the BBC. So you could go on with the acclaim he's gotten, but it sets a bit of a context, I think, about where he came from, poverty in rural Jamaica, from this mixed parentage, struggling in the in the city in Kingston to make a go of it as a pop musician, getting some breaks and becoming an international superstar, really. And remarkably, all along on this theme of raising questions about the relationship between love and justice, oppression and redemption. Well, let's be curious and ask some questions about how we might make sense of this question of making choices in pop culture. Martin Luther has this wonderful example of what goes wrong in our attempt to make sort of claims about the Christian faith. He says we're often like a drunk trying to sit on a horse, and we fall off one side of the horse, and then we get back up and we fall right off the other side of the horse, and it's really hard to stay on the horse. And he was thinking about this in terms of understandings of bondage and freedom of the will. But here you can think about it in terms of ways of making judgments about popular culture. And one way to fall off the side of the horse, I'm arguing, is what I've called checklist Christianity. And there's a kind of just say no that they offer. If these things that you're looking at have any of these list of items which we've predetermined as bad, then just say no. And that's one way I'm arguing that you can fall off the horse. And there's another way you can fall off the horse. And I think it has to do with basically the other version, the liberal progressive version of checklist evaluation, which is to say, oh, for example, Green Day did a recent album called 21st Century Breakdown. Anybody know Green Day? A few of you. Punk rock band came out of Berkeley in the 80s. And this recent album was basically in an opera form. And so the New York Times reviewed it, and just glowing review. They loved the album. And what they loved about it was, oh, here's a punk rock band doing opera as a form, echoing stuff that The Who did and Queen did. So it's sophisticated in terms of its connection to high culture, to opera. It's sophisticated in terms of its drawing on its own tradition in rock and roll. It's musically interesting. It's so anyway, they have this checklist of things, right, that make for good art. And it's not particularly related to faith at all. But they go down the checklist and they say, okay, well, this is sophisticated. This is compelling. It makes us think. It provokes us. So for the New York Times checklist, boom, 21st Century Breakdown is good. You should buy it and listen to it. And Dobson says, you know, it's his own checklist. It includes sex, drugs, profanity, anti-establishment, anti-religion. So, bad. And I'm saying those are both ways of falling off the horse. And what they do is they try and prejudge, as Peter was saying this morning in Bible study, based on the ideology that we have about what you should like, you prejudge what's, in the words of Focus on the Family, what's worth your time, what music comes up clean. I love that. As if there's some kind of laundering going on out there, and we're just looking for the clean things. So there's a divide here that I think is a false divide, to make a choice between flesh and the spirit. You think about the Pauline lists of sins of the flesh and fruits of the spirit. The temptation is to actually divide those and to say some examples like Green Day, sins of the flesh, you know, no fruits of the spirit. Handel's Messiah, fruits of the spirit. You know, to make divides in that way. Well, it turns out that there's some evidence that Handel's Messiah was very controversial when it came out because it was considered in the genre of the theater and created a great hubbub because you weren't supposed to do that. That was an acceptable high culture. I wish Philip was here and I could get him to comment on that. But the idea, in a sense, is that it was critiqued as too fleshly in a way because of the pop cultural patterns it was drawing on. And I think there's some profoundly spiritual reflections and issues to be dealt with in Green Day's album. So I'm wanting to not do this dividing game and to find a way for us to get at the complexity that's there. And the way that I do that in drawing on C.S. Lewis, come now, is to start with this really wonderful and helpful distinction that he offers us from two words that are both used for to know. These are French terms, which I learned how to pronounce at breakfast, talking with Bonnie and Dorothy. Savoir and connaître.
Connaître. Yes.
And he writes about them in this book of essays called God in the Dock. And he has a little piece in there called The Woodshed. And it's in the library. It's a great four-page thing. And he talks about going out to the woodshed behind his house in Oxford. And he goes in the woodshed to get some wood, and the door shuts behind him, and all of a sudden it's dark. And you know when you go into a dark shed and your eyes haven't adjusted yet, it's hard to see. And he sees the ray of sunlight coming in through a crack in the door. He says, savoir is like knowing an object, knowing about something that's in front of you. And he said, so initially I could just see the sunbeam. It was there in front of me and I looked at it as an object. That, he says, is like what we in the modern West love in terms of scientific knowledge, objective knowledge. This is the fact in front of me which I can analyze. And I can hearken back with this kind of knowledge to the way that Focus on the Family, as I said a couple of days ago, goes about their analysis of pop cultural offerings. They treat them like an autopsy. That's the sort of metaphorical world that they use to talk about what they do. So they want to know about this thing and what's there, what are the sort of ligaments and muscles and bones that are there. What are the diseases that are there? And they operate out of that. Connaître, say that for me, French-speaking people.
Connaître.
I don't have that nasal quite right. That, C.S. Lewis says, that is a knowing with. So he says, after I was in the woodshed for a little bit, then my eyes started to adjust and I could look with the sunbeam back out through the crack in the door and see the beautiful blue sky, the trees, and the day. And so he uses that as a sort of simple invitation into thinking about what it is, instead of knowing about this thing in front of you, to get to know relationally who this is enough that you can see with them, what they see, what they feel, what they experience. And by doing that, he says, you begin to know what it is, after all, that they're offering, that they're showing, that they're seeing from their perspective. I mean, this in the end isn't that profound. It's not rocket science. But the difference between the two, he wants to say, is a world. And so here's where he goes with that. The first demand of any work of art, the first demand any work of art makes upon us is surrender. Look, listen, receive. This is from his little book on English literature criticism called An Experiment in Criticism. He really objects to making prejudgments about whether or not this thing is any good. And rather, he wants to ask questions about who do we become by looking with this particular book or song or movie. Who do we become? How does it affect us? How does it change us? How does it lead us in our own life and our own being? So he's shifting, in a sense, in terms of ethics, from rule-based ethics to a character ethics, from trying to understand the act, is this the right act to do or the wrong act to do, to understanding who I am as a person. Let me see where I am. So let me just stop for a second here and think with you about Bob Marley. If you were going to just state some facts about Bob Marley, if you wanted to know about Bob Marley, what would you say? You don't have to pretend you're focused on the family. You can. I mean, they would pick out certain particular things. What's that?
Rastafarian.
He's Rastafarian.
A man who loved.
A man who loved.
Smoked pot.
He smoked pot.
Great bass lines.
Great bass lines.
He had weird hair.
He seemed angry. You know, great love, also great anger.
Yes.
They go together. What else?
Countercultural.
Lots of kids.
Yeah, he did, like 12 or something.
Lived dangerously.
Reggae.
Told the truth and they tried to kill him.
There's a lot of things that begin to emerge. A lot of, if you want to call it, facts. And what do we get when we put those together? Just think with me for a minute. What do we get when we put all those facts we just lifted up together?
He's a man of God.
You might. But how would you get that? From just think, no, work with me here. Just the facts that we just elicited together as a group. How would you get from that to man of God?
The first demand of any work, whether it be art or anything, is to surrender.
But we're not surrendering yet.
Why not?
Because I'm trying to think about what we get to if we don't do that. If we're not doing that.
Make a judgment.
If we're making a judgment based on this knowing about something. We get judgment.
Peter's term this morning was ideology.
We get ideology.
But why would we start there? Because Bob Marley's music, like Lady Gaga's and Son Hauser, is so bodily. The first impulse is to dance. After that, we might find out who they are. But I can't sit still when that music is on, and I don't know who's playing it.
But I'm asking the question, how do we know what to buy for ourselves, for our kids? How do we know what to recommend if we want to take seriously that our faith matters in engaging popular culture? And I think we do. I do. And if we actually, I totally agree. It's impossible for me not to move my body when I listen to actually any of those. And that's a part of why I love music, because it operates somehow differently than consciousness. It happens corporally.
But there are lyrics, and that's what makes it.
But there
sense.
Are lyrics,
right.
And music matters too. So
if the music moves you, are the lyrics something that you can support as well? I mean, we saw that disconnect in the Lady Gaga, but the music and the video were disconnected. But, you know, are the lyrics, I guess, not what I would say harmful, they mean harm.
So some people say, and C.S. Lewis even says this in his book, that we can start tapping our toe and be drawn right into something, either something that's in the end very or quite bad, and we're just drawn into it because it makes us tap our toe, or we can be drawn right into it and never even really receive what's there because we just happen to like it. So all we're receiving is that it makes us tap our toe. And we don't even open ourselves to what's actually there. So a couple of things can happen in that regard. Yeah.
Kind of a good example of that is Eminem's 97 Bonnie and Clyde, where if you're not listening to it, like his voice, the rhythms that he's speaking sound really cool. It's a beat, kids are dancing to it in a dance club. You stop and listen to it, and he's talking about bringing his girlfriend to dump her body in the lake, and he's making it a game with his 2-year-old daughter, and it's horrifying when you realize what they're doing. But there's all these kids dancing to it because it has a great beat.
And isn't that so true of so many of the songs out there? And when you actually stop, I know with confirmation students, to stop and say, so what is this song saying? They'll say, oh, I don't know, I just like the music. Mm-hmm. So it does raise that question. How do you get into separating the sound and the message?
Don't.
At least to analyze it.
Here's an example C.S. Lewis uses. He says, when he was young, he loved Beatrix Potter stories. You know, The Tale of Peter Rabbit and so on. And he says, as an adult, he realized he didn't really look at the pictures. She illustrated her versions of the tales. He thinks as a child he just used the illustrations as springboards for his imagination. He didn't really even attend to what was there. He used them to get someplace himself, in his own imagination. He says their quality and actual detail did not matter that much as a youth, but as an adult he noticed the actual variability of quality in her drawings. And so he takes that and he moves to the question of popular arts in general, and he says, that's the common thing that we do. We do things with it ourselves. We take things that we like and we do things with them for ourselves. And we don't actually open ourselves that much to what's there. And it leads to people grooving on this song, which is actually about a quite horrifying thing, but it's not even really noticed. I think that is what he's trying to point to. And so I think what he's trying to say as a first step is that if we really want to know whether something is something worth paying attention to in a more complex and real sense, then we have to do something other than just tap our toe to it and do something with it that we like. And that's what he's trying to get at in terms of surrender. I think he's trying to get at this idea that, here's what he says, the right spectator is passive. Okay? That's, I mean, we don't really like that. We like to be active. But hers is also an imaginative activity, but an obedient one. She seems passive at first because she is making sure of her orders. If, when they have been fully grasped, she decides they are not worth obeying, in other words, that this is a bad picture, she turns away altogether. So the first step, he says, is to actually surrender enough to move from savoir to connaître, to the knowing with, in order to see what it is that's to be seen there, to, in a sense, receive the orders that song or picture or film want to give. And then knowing that allows you to know, he would say, both more about the world and the whole range of what's being experienced and said, and to have some sense if this is really good or not. So it's a much, I think, what he's trying to get us to do is to a level of knowing that's much more compassionate, in the way Peter Marty was talking about this morning, that really, in the first instance, tries to know who it is that's in front of me. So that's the first step that he recommends. Here's the danger if we don't do that, the tapping your foot issue. Then we just meet ourselves. And this is what I think is the most common checklist Christianity or constricted imagination, is that we fall into one of my sociological teachers, Robert Bella, wrote this great book called Habits of the Heart, and he talks about drawing on Alexis de Tocqueville, this American temptation to follow our feeling and our taste and to create small groups oriented by our tastes, and to not any longer be moved by or engage with those who have tastes different than mine. So Bella called that lifestyle enclaves, people who self-selectively gather in groups of like-mindedness. And so all they really do there is meet their own taste. I worry about this with the church. Like, think about Rick Warren's church, Saddleback. They have what's called venue worship. So they have 26 different styles of worship every Sunday morning. Alternative rock, country western, island Caribbean, classical, your favorite hymns at a lower volume. All these different models of worship, And I think what C.S. Lewis would worry about in that kind of situation is that all we do is go to church and meet ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Would you make a comment about the constricted imagination of the pop culture, though, too? I mean, I have this exact same concern about constantly being wired and hearing only the playlist of my preference. Mm-hmm. And in terms of sensory stimulation, not even open to the natural world, much less another person. Mm-hmm. Or sound. Because I prescribe my playlist on the iPod. And that's what I hear day in and day out.
So your imagination is constricted by the...
The culture.
By the list of things that you listen to.
Well, and it seems to me that globalization is really contributing to that, too.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
You know, where we kind of meet the same stimuli everywhere. Mm. But I think technology is really contributing to that.
I think it, I mean, this is an interesting session we could have on music and globalization, and whether it's in a sense, boxing into narrower streams, the kinds of things that are available, or whether it's opening up just an enormous range of things that we never had access to before. I think you could make an argument in both directions. I think my iPod is hugely more complex now than it was 10 years ago, partly because I have access to so many kinds of music and voices through digital media.
A friend of mine took a J-term trip to Hawaii with a group of students and had very imaginative assignments for how the students would engage Native Hawaiian culture, including their music, and several of the students did not unplug.
Yeah.
To hear the Hawaiian music, they continued to hear the playlist they had brought from home.
Well, that I think that's the judgment that I'm trying to make about our inability to set aside our checklist.
Exactly.
Yeah. Here's another way that he tries to get at working at this. Way we impede, he calls it impeding reception. He's talking children reading a good book. He says the habit of evaluation leads us to fail that inner silence, that emptying out of ourselves, by which we ought to make room for the reception of a work. I mean, it's almost a monastic leaning here. But also, I'll get to this in the end, it's also a deeply Christological sensibility. The emptying out that he's talking about here, the emptying out of ourselves, it is really deeply connected to his understanding of what it is God was doing in Christ Jesus. Philippians 2, the whole the kenosis Christology that in Christ we have this emptying of who he was as God to become human, to become broken for the sake of the reconciliation and healing of the broken. Young readers, he continues, young readers can guide us here. At a first reading of a great work, they are knocked flat. Criticize it? No, by God, but read it again? Yes. Judgment is delayed, sometimes for a long time. The way forward in making judgments comes through guidance in choosing stories, songs, films, and so on that do knock us flat. It is a formation and association with the good. It opens up the habits of being that allows one to know, in fact, what sort of thing this is in front of you. So he's arguing, in a sense, for a communal process of formation of the self by exposure to things that can knock us flat and can lead us into a world and allow us then to begin to inhabit that world and see what can be seen from there. So think of his writing the Chronicles of Narnia, for example. In The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, a couple of kids, four of them, are at this rural manor to escape the bombing in London. Everybody knows this story. Anybody not know The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe? That's not the way to do it, right? Because that would embarrass you. I'll just briefly tell it. He He writes about these four children there, and they're exploring this house. It's a rainy day. They discover the wardrobe, and who goes into it? Lucy? And Lucy goes into the wardrobe while they're playing hide and seek, and she discovers Narnia, this whole other world. And she comes back and tells about it, and they don't believe her. And then later, they're worried about her because Peter also goes into this wardrobe, her brother, and comes back, and she sees him there, and then he lies and says that she just made it up. That
Edmund.
Is it Edmund? Yeah, Peter Wright. Peter's the noble one, and Edmund's the scoundrel. And so Peter and Susan, the two older responsible siblings, go to Professor Kirk, the professor whose manor it is, and they say to him, "We're really worried about Lucy. We think she's lost her mind. She keeps talking about this magical world that she's found in the back of the wardrobe, and she won't admit that it's not true. She keeps holding to it." And so Professor Kirk, you know, pulls his hair, and, "I don't know what they teach kids in school today," he says. "Let's think about this for a minute. Do you generally know Lucy to be one who doesn't tell the truth?" "No, no, she's always been the person who tells the truth." She's obviously not mad, he says. She's quite engaged in our life here in the manor. So he says, "The only thing that you can do in this circumstance is believe that it is actually true, unless you have real reason to think otherwise." In that moment, he's trying to get them out of this judgment and enter into what she's experiencing and say, "Well, what is it she's experiencing? And is that somehow true?" So he's playing in that moment, in that vignette, with what he thinks rational adults often do, which is just make a judgment over against something. Well, that's crazy. That's clearly crazy. Versus what he thinks children are more likely to do and ought to teach us to do, which is enter into the experience of the story of the other and really see what's there and experience it. And that's what he wants to draw in this book on an experiment in criticism. That's what he wants to draw us into. And he takes it toward the end of this book explicitly into theological territory. So this experience, he says, this experience of setting aside our agenda in order to open ourselves to what it is that's in front of us can either be described as an enlargement or as a temporary annihilation of the self, but that is an old paradox. "He that loseth his life shall save it," quoting Jesus about what the life of discipleship is. So there's a particular shape of the self that he's inviting us to. A shape of the self that's in the shape of Christ, who gives himself over, doesn't count equality with God, but gives himself over for the sake of the other and invites us to that same pattern. Well, that leads us to a really different place. And it leads us to a place that's I think, more complex and more difficult and therefore requires, I think, a different kind of relationship to the things that we engage that actually is quite countercultural. We're in a culture of quick dismissal, quick judgment, rooted in taste, rooted in sort of an inflation of my own ego, my own sense of the value of my voice. I mean, just go to any website that has news stories and read through the list of comments that are posted on the article. Such pompousness, usually quite unrelated to what the author was actually saying in the article. It happens in conversations, too, where the listening that's actually going on is in order to formulate the whip-smart comment I'm going to make into the conversation, but really hasn't listened at all to the person who's on the other side of the argument. So, for example, in my own experience, surrendering to really understand what Bob Marley was up to required what C.S. Lewis suggests. It requires not so much reading the critics, but reading about Bob Marley, reading the lyrics of the songs. and then reading commentaries about his life that help me to understand the words that he's using in his songs. It's, in a way, an argument about how it is that you actually open yourself to the complexity of the experience of another. It's not straightforward. It's not easy. It takes listening. It takes wondering and curiosity. And it takes time. And all of those are, I think, virtues that are in short supply in a culture like ours, where American Idol immediately just enters into snide comments after the person has performed. Or just elated applause because the person happens to sound quite like other pop musicians, and so they're judged as potential successes. What do you think about this? Do you think it's workable in a practical sense? This is a challenge to us in how we go about inhabiting our lives and engaging the popular culture that we engage. Think about some other example that you love, not Bob Marley perhaps, but maybe if you went to see Toy Story 3, or I don't know, just give me some of your thinking with me about this proposal that we really turn the way that we engage popular culture toward, instead of making a judgment about that thing being Christian or not, to inhabiting a sort of posture of Christ ourselves as we engage this thing, believing that God is present there and that brokenness is present there. I mean, it is this paradox is pointing to the fact that there's a complexity, a brokenness, and a God redemptiveness already present there that we're meeting. Yeah.
I've recently been sort of turned on to manga and anime by my children, and initially did not like it. The drawing styles can be harsh, and there's an awful lot of violence in it. But most of the themes in it are these themes of redemption and salvation and struggle against oppression that I find engaging and worthwhile. So by taking in a little more of it and seeing these common threads,
it. It's a great example. So how did you get at that?
Repetition. Finding one that I really admired, the drawing and the characterizations, and therefore that one good one that I became most familiar with pulled me in to where I could appreciate the same threads in the others.
I think there's an implication here which I haven't spelled out about developmental capacity. When you're talking about character and development and maturity and discernment, there's a kind of trajectory of development which has to be really carefully attended to. Because some of those themes that you're just describing are significant. They're mature themes. And I was thinking about Bob Marley and at what age I could introduce some of the complexity of his meanings to my children. At what age would they get that? We lived in Atlanta, which is a strongly African-American city, when they were young. And so I think experientially they got some of the issues that he was raising in his songs at an early age because of their... But if they hadn't, it would have been different for me developmentally to work with them and to make some of the connections they needed in their experience in order to be able to really hear at a deeper level what he's singing about. So that's a concern in this perspective. Yeah.
In this series that she's talking about.
This is my child.
Yeah, please.
It's also one of my favorites for the same reasons. But the main character has a much more liberal view on what makes a person human than anybody else in the series, because his little brother was compromised in a way. And most people do not see him as human. That he has a false body, but his soul is still there.
So then it expands, it invites us to think about what being human even is in some provocative ways. Yeah, Sam.
That reminds me of, I have a TV show that I really wrestle with because I think it's the best TV some of the best TV I've ever seen, and it's about a serial killer. It's the show Dexter. And
beautiful.
I know no other. I guess I came at it as an actor first, because that's what I do, and I really admired the actor who plays the central character. And I've decided that I think it's the illumination of the human condition so artfully and so much more richly complex. It's so much more interested in looking at a person, albeit I don't support killing. I don't support any sort of vigilantism, but I find that somehow this show, the writing is better than any of the other writing I've heard in other shows. Therefore, a mixture of acting and writing allows you to a light into a mind, a tortured mind, albeit, and the people surrounding it. But that's one that I've really wrestled with, because I don't like the fact that I wouldn't support him in real life. But I find myself really drawn to the arc of what's being illuminated by this show.
Something you're speaking makes me resonate with having been in the position of visiting people in jail for a variety of different reasons as a pastor. I mean, there's my fidelity to the community, but also these people are absolutely isolated from themselves first, but also from any support network. I absolutely don't condone whatever they're in jail for having done, but it feels like that two minds is, can I enter into this absolute space of vulnerability
and foreignness
to be totally present?
Yeah.
Chris, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
I mean, part of it is we can sit here in a room full of adults and discuss themes and open ourselves to experiencing TV shows or music or film that have mature themes. But the fact of the matter remains, we're not talking about media that is affecting only adults.
Right, absolutely.
And part of the things that Focus on the Family does is try and give those parents some guidelines in which to talk
right.
with their kids. And, I mean, even as your kids are as mature as any I know, but you're there saying, I don't know when I want my son to listen to this, or how
That's
do you
right.
start? How do you start?
Well, one,
getting some things
here's
out
a really, here, so, one really important fact to keep in mind is the developmental issue in capacity to engage ideas. I mean, that's really important. And then community is essential too. Communal discernment is essential in helping hold a context in which you can try out this perspective and then have help in making sense of it. I think that's true, say, when the Harry Potter series was unfolding. And there was a lot of nervousness among some Christian circles, is this good, is this bad, and whatever. And reading and discussing it in community gives a context in which you can make some sense of it and add a kind of communal wisdom and a tradition's wisdom to one person or one child's discernment of it. The other thing I would say about that is, what was the other thing I was going to say about that? I don't know what the other thing I was going to say about it. Bonnie.
Well, I just have a thought to build on what
she
asked and then what you said, which is that, I think what you're saying versus a checklist was sort of illustrated by this conversation that you, as a parent anyway, you enter into the music or the fiction.
There's so much disconnect between parents and children.
Right.
So and this assumes a connection.
To, or you watch,
yeah.
or you read, I'm going back to your connection, with your youth or with your children. Yeah, and in that way, it's not a checklist, it's sort of an entering, I think when you said community, it's entering into a discerning process.
That reminds me of what I was going to say. I read this, there was this, we need to stop, so this is the last thing I'll say and then we can keep the conversation going, but I read this article by Adam Holtz, who's one of the main, he's one of the senior editors for Plugged In, Focus on the Family's Media Ministry. And the question this blogger, this young 20-something blogger asked him was, why do you review sick R-rated movies like the Saw series? And it was interesting. He said, one, we review those movies because kids are going to them. And we want to review what kids are going to. And two, he said, we want to engage the full range of what's out there, not just review things that are nice, because our whole point is to say what's wrong with the movie like that. And then in the comments section on the blog, there was this whole debate going among kids who were commenting on it about what happens when you say certain kinds of movies, according to a certain kind of checklist, are off limits. And they were raising questions about how great, how in fact profound some R-rated movies are. So they were talking about Schindler's List, for example, which according to a certain kind of checklist is full of problems. But at the same time, in the context of the story, those problems of violence and profanity and sexuality and sort of bizarre twisted religion and whatever tell a story that's profoundly important to learn about. So the kids themselves were making this claim about the limits of just a sort of black-white yes-no measure. And I thought, well, that's interesting because they're grappling in a more complex way with this stuff than the adults who are making the judgments for them. And that's exactly what led me on this trajectory in the first place with these kids in the video, in the AV booth at Mount Vernon who were trying to figure out how to work with Kanye West and didn't have much help from their professors. So, well, there's lots more to be gotten out of this journey of conversation, but thanks for coming and engaging with me for this hour.